From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1959 when a man was walking through sand dunes in Oregon. As described by The Guardian, the man, a freelance writer, was wearing Ray-Ban aviators and army surplus clothing as he did research about a USDA program to stabilize the shifting sands. The writer was Frank Herbert, who many listeners may now know as the author of the 1965 sci-fi classic Dune. Dune is a space opera that tells the story of a resource-deprived galaxy 8,000 years in the future. It explores a number of themes that are relevant in 2021. Climate change, water allocation, religion, race, the danger of power, feminism, bigotry, and more. 50 years after its publication, millions of copies of Dune have been sold, and it's considered by many to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, novel in the sci-fi canon. The book was adapted into a 1984 film by director David Lynch, which apparently no one saw or should. But then again this year by the director Denis Villeneuve. The film opened on Friday, and among other places, you can see it at the Little Theater, which, full disclosure, of course, is owned by WXXI. If you're a Dune fan, we want to hear from you this hour. If you're a Dune critic, we want to hear from you as well. And you do not have to be a Dune fan to appreciate this. I knew nothing about Dune as recently as yesterday morning, and then I crammed, and then I watched the movie last night, and I was surprised that it was 9 hours long, but I got through the whole thing. I thought it was fascinating. I love the notion of thinking 8,000 years in the future and thinking about what do the resources look like? Who has the power? What world are we left with? What do we do when water is scarce? And there's so much more to it. It was very, very interesting. So let's talk about it now with our guests here. Matt Kelly is a Dune fan and independent journalist. Is Dune the greatest? Is it the greatest in the canon?
Yes, absolutely. Glad to be here again.
Oh, man. It's great to have Matt. You want to just host? I'll come back in an hour.
No.
Okay, I'll stay. Adam Libitos, film writer and programmer. Is it the greatest?
I enjoy it. I'm not a hardcore Dune fan. I've never read the books. I'll start like right off the bat saying that. I've only seen the movie adaptations. So that's the extent of my knowledge.
All right. Do we have Jackie? We've got Jackie and Eddie. Yeah. Hey, Jackie McGriff, owner of Jackie Photography, co-founder of the Our Voices Project and a movie fan. Hey, Jackie, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Great to have you. Abby Sitterly is a Dune fan and freelance writer. Hi, Abby.
Hey, Evan, how's it going?
Great. All right. So we're off and running here. Let's just start with the basics. I don't want to get too nerdy on Dune right away because a number of listeners have no idea what we're talking about. So let's start with why this is a film. This was a book. This is now a film that is so compelling. What are the issues that are relevant to us today that you don't have to be a Dune super fan to think? Because for me, it was, I love thinking 8,000 years in the future. How have we survived? What does power look like? Are we in egalitarian society, or have we concentrated power even more? Resource allocation. Matt Kelly, give me a little bit. Do the short elevator pitch version of tell the short story of Dune, and then let's talk about some of the issues that are exciting to you.
Go ahead. Sure, absolutely. So, short story, sort of swashbuckling story of Dune is this is set 8,000 years in the future on a desert planet, where this planet is super important to this imperial human empire that's spread across the galaxy because it is the only source of this mind-altering substance called spice, which is essential for interstellar travel. Like, you can't travel these distances. You have to have people take this substance to navigate these vast interplanetary differences. Planet is given to feudal families to kind of extract this substance from. It's a very colonial, very extractive sort of process. It is given to the Atreides family, which through deception and deceit is overthrown, which takes our main character, Paul Atreides, into the desert to join with the Fremen, who are the native people of this planet who have never been conquered, despite what the feudal houses might think, have never been conquered by these noble houses. And they join forces and rise up against their imperial overlords.
All right. What are the themes that really ring true to you?
So the themes, first and foremost, are the ecological themes through this. I mean, in one of the many things that I've read about Dune, somebody has said that without ecology, Dune would completely collapse. Like, it's just such a key pillar and foundational part of this story. And that's absolutely true. The second piece is the sort of exploration and criticism of power, particularly superheroes, single people, cults of personality, and why that is so poisonous to a society. But the third thing that I find extraordinarily fascinating, and again, I promise not to nerd out too much at this point. We'll save that for later. But one of the most fascinating elements that Herbert introduces into this sort of future world is this idea that there is no smart technology. Within the first 20 pages of the book, he tells us about, in this vast human history, which is our current history that he's referring to, humans created machines that were so smart we became slaves to them. There was actually a human revolution that overthrew those machines. And in this future world, you don't have smart machines.
And by choice.
By choice. It's actually sort of a religious decree at this point. You don't make machines in the image of man. And so everything that happens in this world is based on human agency. It's about developing human skills, human ability to be able to navigate the stars, to be able to think super fast, to be able to do all these things that we currently rely on machines for.
And I have to say, Matt, you have been on this program talking about AI in the past. One of the reasons I like that plot construct, there's two reasons. Number one, it does allow for a real human story to still be told, a real personal story that isn't just technology does everything, we can't possibly comprehend it. But it's also realistically plausible to me that in the future, we may get to a point where we say, we've gone too far, we've got to pull technology back from the brink here. Unrealistic as that may be, it's plausible to me.
Yeah, I think one of the most fascinating things about Dune, for all the sort of fandom and criticism that it will receive, is Frank Herbert in this particular book, with this initial book, did a brilliant job of really drawing on believable social, political, and religious mechanisms to create this universe. Everything that's in this universe in this first book, you're exactly right. Like, you can look throughout human history and go, oh, I can totally see a connection there. This is believable.
Yeah. Jackie, for you, what stands out? What are the themes that draw you in on this?
For me, honestly, like the whole... I mean, it's pretty evident, like, especially in the movie adaptation, is like water obviously being scarce, but also like water being used as this kind of like power thing. You know, those who hold, obviously, like, have the most water are the ones who have the most power. And so it's, of course, explained more in more detail in the book about this. But again, just like having it being relevant in 2021 with the talk of all of the talk about power structures and everything, and really like who holds the power, who holds the privilege, that to me resonates the most.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. Adam, there's too much stabbing in this movie for me. I find it very stabby. I don't like stabbing. And I think that everybody whispers too much. I'm getting older. I cannot hear you if you're only whispering. What's going on there? You're a film critic. Help me understand this trend of dramatic whispering.
Oh, I don't know if I can help you understand it, but I feel like it's definitely a thing with especially modern blockbusters where the mixing is, everyone whispers and then the action scenes are like anytime you watch a movie like this on your television, you're constantly adjusting the volume because you're like, I can't understand the dialogue. Oh my God, I can't stand the explosions and the score now.
That's exactly what happened. I had a 9-year-old sleeping upstairs who wanted to sit on the stairs and watch Dune. I'm like, not for you, dude. And I would crank it to hear the whispers and then something would blow up and I'd be like, he's going to be awake. This is a disaster.
Yeah, I wish I had an explanation for it. Somebody might, but I don't know why that's become
Matt Kelly's looking
standard.
At us like, you guys are so old.
No. I'm going to totally agree. I'm happy to break down the movie.
And that's why
totally.
I definitely turned down closed captioning just for that reason. So I can keep it at a decent volume and understand what was being said.
Well, by the way, engineer Rob Braden says, hello, Evan. It's because you're supposed to see it on the big screen, which, Adam, we've talked about. This may be a film that's even better seen in a movie theater, right?
Yeah, this is definitely a spectacle. And I can absolutely see, you know, watching it on the biggest screen possible would entirely change the experience.
And it's not nine hours. It's 2.5. Do you like it? Is it good, Adam?
Yeah, I do. I really enjoyed it as a movie. I have quibbles and critiques with it as a movie. I felt like the last act kind of drags.
Careful. Yeah. Without giving too much.
Oh, no. And I will state that this, we say last act in the movie, but that's also the middle, since this is going to be two movies. This is just...
Oh, it's two. It's not going to be three. It's two.
My understanding was two. Yeah. Okay. So this is, the first half. And, you know, I can't say I connected emotionally to the characters, mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it. And also there are things like, you know, for a universe that is clearly owes so much influence to Middle Eastern culture, I thought it was kind of a glaring oversight that there really wasn't any Middle Eastern representation in the cast and then the main cast. I feel like that becomes noticeable when you watch just, you know, the design of things, the language, the music, even you can clearly see that influence. So I would have liked to see that reflected more in the cast.
Okay.
Abby Sitterly, what did you think of Dune? That's how people talk in this the whole time.
I don't know. But anyway, go ahead.
I got to tell you, I did not notice that. But on my second watch through, I will open my ears a little bit more. Yeah, I loved it. I went to see it Friday night. And for me, I am almost finished with the book. I'm just about there. But I am kind of familiar with Dune because I'm a huge David Lynch fan. So his adaptation came out in 1984. But this is really interesting because there was someone before him that tried his hand at directing, Jodorowsky, and he was never able to finish the film. So then David Lynch did it, bad reviews, and now Dennis has done it. And I mean, I can't say anything more highly about it. There's so many themes in Dune that really reach for a contemplative approach to these ideas of futuristic ecology and like climate change, as you said, but then also our fascination with these like messiah stories, I think, is interesting too. And yeah. Dennis's version really capitalizes on all of those.
So let me ask all of you, I'll start with you, Abby. You know, when you think about, you brought up messiah stories, there's a very interesting take on religion in the future, obviously resource, climate change, ecology. Are you looking for a film like this to just tell a good story with these elements, or do you want it to say something?
I think what this is one of the things that I kind of consider to be like what I call reaching content, which is content that's not actually, or narratives rather, that aren't actually looking to answer something, but rather contemplate the reach itself. So I think it's part of the human condition that we're longing for answers and meaning. And sci-fi is one of the most, I think, prescient ways that we sort of look into that with the uncertainty of future days and opportunities. So I'm looking for it because I'm interested in it, but I think all of us are looking for it because we intrinsically desire that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Jackie, what do you want from a movie like this?
Well, it's kind of on the lines of like what Abby was saying. I mean, whenever I go to a movie and if it's like this huge sci-fi epic and everything, I mean, I feel like as a society, or at least for me, I can only speak for me, I'm used to that. Like I'm used to looking for themes and finding them. So for instance, like, you know, like a Star Wars or a fantasy film, like Lord of the Rings, I'm always looking for messages, you know, within the narrative. And so with this, I definitely, and having read at least the first book of Dune, I always look for stuff that I can really resonate, that really speak to today's time. So like I was saying before about, you know, who holds the power and everything, I thought, again, that's something that jumps out at me because it's the first thing that I notice. And whether or not the author was initially like intending to say something about it, that's what jumps out to me and that's what I look for. So absolutely, that's what I expected going into this. And that's that, some of that is what I got.
Adam, you want to be entertained first, or do you want a film like this to say something meaningful?
I feel like that gets back to, I think we've had this conversation a few times on the show when I've been on that. I feel like the best is the perfect kind of the balance, that you're entertained and it can be a spectacle and, you know, pure entertainment, but also, you know, weave in some messages so it's not just, I hate movies where you describe like you just turn your brain off and watch. I feel like
Halloween Kills. You probably loved that.
I actually haven't seen it yet.
Oh, you haven't.
But even movies like that, I feel like there are ideas going on there. I can't speak to that one specifically because I haven't watched it yet. But I feel like the best entertainment, you know, even if you're not immediately aware of it, it doesn't hit you over the head with it. There are still things to grasp onto beyond just like, that was fun.
Yeah, and maybe Matt Kelly in a film like this, it doesn't have to answer all the questions, but I can't help but immediately when you see a film that's in the year, what, 10,100 AD, think, how realistic is it that we're going to see resources that starved and that there's going to be wars over water and fuel, spice in this case, and things like that? I think about climate change. I think about all that stuff. It doesn't have to answer them all to me, but it really certainly got me thinking, even the AI stuff.
Yeah, I'm not bought in that it has to be an either or in the case of entertainment versus messaging.
Yeah.
But I think I'm always, whether I'm watching a movie or reading a book or reading an article or anything like this, the first question I'm getting, when it's fiction, the first question I'm always asking is, what's the message here? What am I supposed to take away from this? Even the most simplistic films like the Halloween slasher movies. I mean, the message you're taking away a lot of the time is that the good guy wins. Like, that's really what you're taking away sometimes. Or maybe that bad guys win. Like, you know, that's kind of what the message is.
Stupidity kills. That's usually the message.
That's even a better one. But I mean, messages can be that simple, or it can be the thoughtful crafting of a message that you're trying to tell. It can be any of these things. And I am not a fan of any sort of entertainment form that doesn't have a message. There's got to be something. And sometimes it can be intentional, and sometimes it's unintentional. And that's actually one of the interesting things about doing the book, is I think there were a lot of intentional messages in there. And then the criticism of the book comes from perhaps the unintentional messages that came from being a white author in the 1960s, a white male author. You know, as far as the movie itself goes, you know, the director, Villeneuve, I'm sorry if I messed that
Villeneuve?
Up.
Villeneuve.
Villeneuve. Thank you. Ninth grade French, not paying off. sorry, ninth grade French teachers. He said specifically he wanted this to be his best pop movie ever. And so I didn't expect too much messaging-wise. I think they could have done a better job with it, though.
Interesting. And then you wonder what the second half is going to end up being there. Before we let Jackie McGriff go, because she's got to get out of here early, what would you say to listeners who maybe haven't read the book and aren't Dune buggies, whatever they are?
Wow, that's good.
Dune dudes.
Oh, my God.
What would you say to prepare? Because honestly, I was in that category. I found the film pretty dense. It moves pretty fast. I mean, there's a lot of talking and a lot of stabbing and a lot of talking and a lot of whispering, but I felt like I was introduced to a lot of characters quickly, and it was a bit of a struggle to understand some of the reasoning between what the families were doing and why. What would you tell people to sort of prepare themselves?
Oh my God. Evan, you just like explained, you just went through everything that I've, for the past couple of days now, have been talking about on Twitter, and I won't shut up about it. Because here's the thing, is like, having read the book, there are certain things that you're meant to understand. Remember, I was talking about that, the whole like, the water is power. Water is scarce, but it's also power. There are little things within the movie that you're supposed to, in understanding that theme, you get. But the real big thing, so there's, not to spoil the movie, because I'm not, I hate spoilers, I hate it. So to not spoil it, there's this thing that happens in the movie that then catapults everything else after that. And in the movie, or rather in the book. And so in the movie, there's nothing leading up to this moment. It sort of just happens, and then things start happening, like right then and there. Like if they took some time to really explain, like to explain a little bit more about the families, how they came into this, and then also, again, because I'm trying not to spoil the movie, if they explained certain things about this character that then catapults a bunch of other things happening in the movie, I think people would have understood a little bit more of the dynamics, a little bit more of, like, again, those power structures that you're talking about.
We talking about Paul and his mom? Just, who are you talking about? You talking about Paul?
I'm talking about, okay, there's someone who works with the family that does something. This is me talking cryptically because I'm also trying not to spoil
You can
things
talk. No, you can people. Talk. We've given spoiler alerts. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So basically, there's a doc, they're trying to, in the beginning of the book, they're trying to figure out who, because they know that there's someone close to them that is going to betray them at some point, but they're trying to figure out who it is. And so it's Dr. Yu, and they're trying to, leading up to that, they're trying to find out who it is. And of course, they end up thinking it's like someone else, but then at some point in the book,
the mother starts to figure out who it is, but then by that time it's too late. This person has now betrayed the family, and that's what starts again setting things really in motion moving forward. But without that, like in the movie, without that, like leading up to kind of like trying to figure out, okay, who is this who tried to kill Paul? Who is this who is working with the Harkonnens? And it doesn't happen in the movie. It just sort of happens. This person has now betrayed the Atreides family.
Yeah, it was confusing to me too. Yeah.
Yeah. So that whole part, like leading up to that, there is none of that in the movie. So again, it just kind of happens. And that was one of my biggest criticisms of the movie. And I am forever a Denis Villeneuve like stan. Forever, because I there you go. Listening to interviews, I'm like, okay, how do you say his name? So I get that, because I also 9th, 10th grade French. Yeah, it's since left me. But like, I loved Arrivals. I loved Blade Runner 2049. I loved Prisoners. I absolutely adore this director. He's one of my favorites. But I just felt like a little bit of the story was missing, because you don't get those little nuances that are explained in the book. And not to say that you have to go into full detail, because of course no movie is going to match exactly the book, because you know you have so much time in the book to explain things. But if you just add a little bit more of those things into there, it would have made for a fuller storyline as far as when you're talking about themes.
It also would have made for a 3-hour movie. 2 hours, right. 36 minutes. Hey, Jackie, we got to let you go for your own time. Yes. But thanks for joining the nerd conversation today. Always good.
Yeah, of course. And Matt, thank you for the lesson there in Dune. I'm excited to read the rest of it. So, yeah, man, whenever you want to talk offline, let me know.
Absolutely. You got it.
Jackie's the owner of Jackie Photography, co-founder of the Our Voices Project, big movie fan. We'll let Jackie go now. Let me grab a phone call from Keith, because I think this is building on the question of why is there not AI technology. He's wondering, why is everybody stabbing each other 8,000 years in the future? Go ahead, Keith.
You hit the nail on the head on that. At least George Lucas, when he came up with a sword, it was a lightsaber, so it had a certain panache to it. But I also liked the costuming in it, especially in the beginning. I thought they were real good. And Stellan Skarsgård, he plays a really wonderful bad guy, because I remember seeing him in Angels and Demons, too. He is a good bad guy. But you had somebody on that commented about, he said a movie had to have something good that he wanted to see. And I forgot what it was, but with me, I like a good story, and a very simple movie that had a very good story, I thought, was Cruella. I thought the story was excellent. I don't know if you saw that, but...
Right, but this is a Dune conversation, but go ahead.
All right, no, he had mentioned that it had to have another meaning to it.
Oh, yeah, I got you, yep.
He said a good movie had to have a meaning, and I go, no, I'd rather have a good storyline than a meaning.
So of all things, it's Cruella.
I just want to be entertained.
Keith, thank you as always. But Keith's wondering, why 8,000 years in the future is there so much sword and knife fighting going on? Matt Kelly?
Okay, you're about to unleash the nerd. You ready for this?
Do it. Let's do it.
So one of the things you miss out on this movie, one of the things they don't explain, which again gets explained in the Dune book very early, is this idea of restricting technology. And part of that is part of religious edict, but the other part is how technologies actually work. So they have these shields, right? Super cool. Deflect things, basically impervious. They also have laser gun technology. And what they discover very quickly in this future human history is that when you put the two together, when you shoot shields with laser guns, you get this massive explosion that destroys basically everybody involved. So what they end up relying on is knives and sword fighting.
Okay, by choice.
Oh, yeah, because you can't penetrate a shield with something fast. If you remember when Paul Atreides is training with Gurnik Halley and they've got the shields on, he's like, you've got to know Harkonnens, and then boo boo, and they're fighting and stuff like that.
So hold on, but what you're describing was the dude, was that the dude from Aquaman?
No, you think that's Duncan Idaho. He's separate.
This was, Who was this?
This was Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
Josh Brolin, who played George W. Bush in one movie, is now in this movie in the future.
Correct.
And he's like, he's kind of like the mentor for Paul's
character. The warrior
mentor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So for this young kid who's kind of like, people are wondering if he's the chosen one. He's training him in a battle, but training him in a way where he can't be hurt, right?
Well, yeah.
I didn't get that. I couldn't understand that.
Again, it's the things you miss out. Like, all of the complexity of the Dune book becomes a footnote in this movie. They just compress stuff so much. The idea is that the only way to penetrate a shield is to move slowly through it. So that's why it's all the knife fighting. The only way you're going to get through these impervious shields is with blades. You're not going to get through it with bullets or lasers or any of these other possible technologies. You have to move slowly, move through the shield, and then stab. And so that's why you have these sort of like this weird blending of like super futuristic and old school technologies. Okay. And I will say that's really nerdy to talk about on its own, but it makes sense in this. The whole world of Dune in the book is that blending of old with new.
I have to say, I actually don't think that's that nerdy and footnotey. I think that that's very interesting to think about a world in the future in which humankind is reevaluating what technology is a bad idea. Guns, nuclear weapons, AI, those are all on the table. And Dune addresses all that. I actually think that's very interesting. I don't think that's that nerdy. I think that's very cool. Abby, what do you make of that? Was the movie a little too stabby for you, or are you okay with that?
No, I'm fine with that. I grew up reading a lot of sci-fi and fantasy novels, so it was just really welcome. And to see even that like very, I don't know, niche Renaissance element to it is so perfectly translatable in the adaptation from the book. I was really struck by that as a book lover, I am always like really nervous watching any of my favorite narratives on the screen and like holding my breath. But it was such a welcome surprise to see so many details, including the Christ knife scenes, to be reflective of a lot of accuracy in Herbert's writing.
And after we take our only break of the hour, I want to ask our panel about the question of a Messiah character. That has come up not only in this discussion. I found it a little confusing in the movie. And again, I haven't read the book. We're talking about Dune here, which has become a phenomenon. But part of the warning that I think Matt Kelly brings up, that the movie seems to bring up, is putting too much power and worship and control in a cult of personality. I think it rings true in 2021, but it's also an interesting idea for just how far we can go with that. That's also why I was a little confused on the Paul character, but I think I'm starting to figure it out, and I'm going to see how good of a Dune student I am on the other side of this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, candidates for Rochester City School Board at a crucial time for the city. You'll hear from the candidates at length, and then a conversation about a warning for Democrats from David Shore, who is not exactly a pollster, a data analyst, who says Democrats could be up for big losses in federal elections. What do local Democrats say? We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. We're talking about Dune with Adam Lubiteau and Matt Kelly and Abby Sitterly. And with you, listeners, if you want to share your thoughts on Dune, we've got a lot of feedback of people who really like it and maybe are just confused by it. It's a space opera. It's a sci-fi film. It's intense. It's a little dark. It's pretty. It's a lot dark. And set 8,000 years in the future. And there's a character in the film named Paul. And how old is Paul, by the way?
15.
15 years old. Paul is developing an ability to use a voice that his mother is teaching him. I didn't know if that meant right away that he was like some sort of a messianic figure, a chosen one, or if that's just part of the religious order. I still don't know if I understand that. I also think this is a film that warns against cults of personality, and yet Paul is sort of becoming this chosen one. He can kind of see the future. He has these visions. But my hypothesis on the message is this. Instead of taking that path of being a chosen one and all of sort of the glory and the power accumulation that can go with it, he makes a choice without giving too much away to sort of to join people who've been repressed instead of joining the elite who are doing the repressing. So let's go around the table. I'll start with Matt. How am I doing with that?
Ish.
Yeah. Okay. Ish.
Ish.
Okay. It was an interesting choice.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think...
it wasn't just because he's in love with Zendaya, I don't think.
Although I'm sure that helps.
Yeah.
So I think the only thing I would add to what you just described, I think a critical piece is he didn't choose to leave his family to go join with these you know, indigenous people of Arrakis. First of all, his father's whole premise, and this is just from the movie, I'm not even talking about the book, his father's whole premise is like, people go to this planet for spice and they think that's the power. And he's like, no, it's the people are the power. And so you get this kind of nice initial message, like, we're going to give power to the people. But all they really want to do is just leverage the native people of this planet to fight back against the Imperial forces and the Harkonnens and the other people. So it's very colonial in a certain respect.
So these indigenous, the indigenous people of this planet,
Fremen, yeah,
they have adapted, they figured out a way to live in harsh conditions. They recycle their own sweat and tears for drinking.
Any fluids coming out of the body, yep.
Any fluids for drinking and sustenance, they figured out a way to do it. They have not been conquered, but everyone who's powerful who comes to this planet comes because it's a source of spice, which is not only a drug that turns your eyes blue and helps, what, your own vitality, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good enough.
Again, we're trying here. But it's also a source of fuel to travel in an interstellar fashion.
Not fuel. The whole idea is that the only way you can navigate between stars, we don't have complex computers. Humans have to make all of those mathematical computations. They have to understand how to bend space. So in order to bend space, you have to take a lot of this spice so that your mind takes on these, like, superpowers to be able to do that.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. But anyway, it's a huge resource. It's extremely valuable. And this has been an exploited people. And so Paul is a character that I couldn't figure out here. I mean, maybe Abby can help me out. Is Paul a messiah? How would you describe... how am I supposed to understand Paul?
Sure. I mean, archetypically, I think he fills that role pretty well as far as narrative goes. But I think that's something that you might have to wait for part two to find out. Certainly, I know, I hate to break it to you, but I think there's certainly that temptation to maybe go into a darker interpretation of that. But then also, you know, there's something to be said for a sort of disparate... people on the Fremen on Arrakis could certainly unite behind a powerful figure. So there is that opportunity for it. But yeah, I think it speaks to our weird penchant for these sort of stories.
So hold on a second. I gotta get an Adam. I gotta get the non-Dune head, and then Matt's gonna jump in. Let me just ask you. I'm very curious to know, since you had less of a Dune background than Abby and Matt did going in, you were more like me, I think, right?
Yeah.
Had read the book. What was your takeaway, generally speaking? What commentary on religion are you getting from this film?
I think I got some similar things you did, that, you know, there's that messiah and cult of personality aspect, and it seemed to be, you know, portraying that in a negative light, especially since, you know, by the end of this movie, Paul is saying he doesn't want it. And since he's, you know, the main protagonist, I feel like you're automatically kind of going on his perspective. It's also interesting since, you know, I feel like by necessity of like the one stories, and those characters are kind of a blank slate, or the blankest of all the characters in it, so you can kind of just project yourself onto it, and you like see things from their perspective, and you bring your own kind of interpretation to their actions. At least that was kind of what I was going along with it. And yeah.
Okay. Let's leave it there, and then let's just ask Matt here now. I know you want to jump in here. Also, give me a sense for what this religious order is and what we as viewers are supposed to kind of make of it.
Right. So, well, again, I think that's the difficulty of a movie that's trying to be the best pop movie a director has ever made with a book that's really exploring issues. I think in terms of the movie, I just want to go back to how you kind of described Paul's arc and your kind of confusion about what this is about. So like if Dune is this sort of deconstructing and this real questioning and criticism of the power of one, this superhero figure, you know, and Paul seems to be on this track. I think the only thing I want to add in without giving anything away is I think in order to criticize something, you have to create that in the story, right? Like, we couldn't have criticism of it necessarily unless Paul starts to follow that track. That's just sort of a typical dramatic arc. And I do agree. I think, you know, I'll be curious to see what they do with the second half. I think it'll be really interesting whether the second half becomes something that sort of answers these questions, or if it just becomes a second movie to sell action figure toys. You know what I mean? It'll be really interesting to see what happens.
Okay, but the religious order itself,
Oh, the religious order itself.
Help me understand.
So if we're talking about the Bene Gesserit, which is Paul's...
Bene Gesserit.
So Paul's mother is a part of this female religious order that is centuries old.
All women,
because the whole point of this religious order is to perfect humans. It's very much...
And I love that perfecting humans includes no men.
Well, correct. Well, until you get to the perfect human. Like, that's the whole argument that the Reverend Mother has with Jessica, which is like, hey, you were supposed to have women to help us continue this evolution towards a perfect human, but then you met this guy you liked, and you were like, I'll have a male instead. You screwed everything up for 1,000 years. Thanks a lot. And that's why they come and they test Paul to see if he's really, quote-unquote, the one.
So by having only women, they're just looking at it as like building blocks, like, you know, the next... You know, evolution until it
becomes like designing a new car.
Yes.
Yeah, but then once they're like, okay, this is a pretty good model. Now we have to have a man to. Is it that's how that works?
Correct. Yeah. Like in the
come on, ladies, you don't need a man for this.
This is criticism of the story, right? Like this is how it rolls. But again, the more depth you get in the book is that, you know, the Bene Gesserit don't think in terms of 5-year plans or 25-year plans. They think in terms of 25 generations. And which again, when you think about a future 8,000, what will humans be like 8,000 years in the future? That's part of the interesting thing to think about. Like, what if we were really thinking that long term about stuff? But again, their planning is all around perfecting humanity.
For what purpose?
To make perfect humans. I think the way they would describe it, because I'm trying to not give away elements of the story here.
Go ahead.
Okay. Is basically the comparison she tells Paul when, I don't think they did this in the movie, but in the book, he puts his hand in that box and she has a needle to his neck. And she's like, look, I'm testing to see whether you're a human or you're an animal.
I think that happens in the movie.
Yeah. And if you're an animal, I don't care if you die. But right. If you're a human, our definition of a human, you get to carry on. So it's, you know, the whole history of eugenics in the real world has just been about perfecting humanity for the sake of humanity. And that's what I have taken away from the storyline as well. That's sort of...
Yeah, eugenics is bad, right? I should think that this is bad,
yeah.
Shouldn't I?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's... What is interesting about the book is he creates this religious order that is about... And all the noble houses know this. It's not like it's a secret. Like, everybody knows that this is going on. But he creates that element in this story, I think, specifically to criticize it, much like we're talking about with the Messiah. And I think it's also a thought experiment for him. I think a lot of what Dune is this is a guy that had a lot of ideas about a lot of things. And was it Jessica or Abby that said this? You know, sci-fi it's basically a sandbox for ideas, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's an opportunity to really play with stuff and say, what if?
And not everything becomes fully formed. I get that.
Yeah.
But Abby, come on here. We do not need a feminist order having to then turn to a man for perfection here. Come on. I'm not on board here. Am I missing something?
I mean, the battle of the sexes wages on, even in 10,100.
It's never going to die. 8,000 years in the future.
How perfectly human, though.
It is. That is actually a good way to describe it. How do you feel about this order, then, Abby?
Well, in watching the movie, I really had to give Hans Zimmer a little credit because his score for the Bene Gesserit is really interesting. It kind of reminded me of like the Compline service at Christ Church on East Ave. I love going there, and I just was really struck how even like those elements of religion in the book are still tied to religions that we sort of have today. So like in the book, they read the Orange Catholic Bible, which is sort of like our understanding of translation error over 10,000 years. So if you think the translations of religious texts today are interesting, you'll certainly find the Orange Catholic Bible to be quite remarkable. But I find any sort of religious aspect in sci-fi to be fascinating because, I think you said it great, the sort of sandbox for ideas that it is, it still acknowledges like these very human faculties such as this need for spirituality and the need to have category within spirituality and have some sort of organized sense to whatever the sort of ephemeral belief is. So I thought it was really cool, all that to say.
Go ahead, Matt.
I just want to jump in quick because I think one of the other interesting aspects to think about in terms of how Dune approaches women and reproduction and stuff like that is the fact that the women, the Bene Gesserit, can actually choose the sex of their child. And there has been at least one piece written by a reproduction biologist who was like, I mean, a guy was writing about women having choice over reproduction in the 1960s when like all reproduction science and conversation was about like sperm counts, all about the guy's side.
So there's a feminist idea there, you think?
I don't know if it is. Again, I couldn't tell you whether Herbert goes, you know what? I think we need to think more about women. So I'm going to write this in.
but sometimes it happens by accident.
But that's the sandbox, right? Like he's building this world, and if they're trying to craft the perfect human, women aren't just the ones doing it. They actually make a decision within their bodies on which sex their child's going to be. And I would say that Jessica is probably one of the most powerful characters in this book. I mean, mm-hmm. I thought, I can't even remember the actress's name. The woman they got to play Jessica was
Rebecca
brilliant.
Ferguson.
There you go. Yeah, brilliant. I thought she was brilliant.
Ask the critic, you agree? What did you think, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in general just a fan of that actress. But yeah, and from my understanding, I don't know, they kind of expanded her character. From my understanding, she didn't have as major a role in the book. I thought maybe I'm wrong.
She was super major, yeah.
Well, absolutely. Then I had wrong information from whoever in my
right. But she was social media. She was really good. Yeah. You liked her, yeah.
And I just to kind of jump on the sandbox of ideas, I think that's kind of what's cool about adapting a book like Dune, in that there's so many ideas in there that when people decide to make a movie of it, they can kind of pick and choose what threads they want to focus on and what they want to pull in and what is important to them. So like for me, I would love to see people return to this and make their own a new Dune every few years, because I feel like there's so much mm-hmm. there, and you would get a completely different movie every time.
Yeah, you could. Maybe even more so than a world like Star Wars, which is is always going to be mined for ticket sales, etc. Dune does have a huge world to come from. I did get a note from a listener who wanted to know, where's Earth in all of this? Where's Earth in the Dune world, Matt Kelly?
Earth is, if I'm not mistaken, it's the seat of the Imperial House. It's basically the throne.
Okay. So Earth's still there. Amazing. But Frank Herbert participated in the first Earth Day, from what I have read. And it's interesting. I mean, the ecological themes that we've been talking about are really key here in this book. I can't help but watch a film like this and feel like any film set this far in the future, I feel like it's kind of a warning. Like, this is sort of where we're going. Do you want this to be the world that we live in? And there are aspects of this that I think are very wise. I admit, I think the AI story in Dune is very wise. I don't know if it's practical or possible that we're going to choose as a society not to access and create and exploit technology for our greater good, but I think it's possible. And I love the idea that here's an author in 1965 who's thinking about that. I thought that was great. But I also just think the climatological issues, the resource issues are so big. We think so poorly. That's why the Bene Gesserit thinking thousands of years in advance is so much more interesting than when we think about 25 years, 50 years, 100 years. Because we don't think on timescales that are going to benefit human beings, living things, in perpetuity, or at least the next 10,000 years. That's not even that long. And I feel like this film is a warning to us. This was an author who appeared at the first Earth Day celebration, who clearly wanted us to think about some of these things. And you remember, this was written 56 years ago or whatever it was. So let me ask all three of you a little bit about that. I mean, Abby, I couldn't help but look at this and think, gosh, is it inevitable? This is where we're going. It's sort of bleak in a lot of ways. Maybe it's more hopeful to you. How did you take some of that?
That's a good thought. I'd say, I guess I didn't really read too much into the like current day application of those things. I certainly think that you can. But I think going forward, it's like whatever technology has for us tomorrow is going to be what it is in some sense. I guess I didn't really read too much into it, honestly.
I mean, part of the reason I do, yeah. I mean, ever since I started hosting the show in 2014, I've had on my big board, mm-hmm. and we've never had this conversation, but I thought it'd be interesting to get philosophers and ecological specialists and people from different disciplines to ask, are we living at the most comfortable point in human history. In other words, whenever the human story is over, will we look back and be like, you know, 2018, that was like the most comfortable. Like you could go outside under a sky and breathe, and the standards of living, even for people in poverty, weren't great, but they, you know, you could live, you could get by. People had smartphones. They weren't worried about, you know, I mean, it was like, I look at the future as depicted in Dune, and the future is depicted in a lot of films, and I think, I don't know, maybe we are. Maybe we take this for granted. Maybe we're not working hard enough to extend this level of sort of possible happiness, because everything looks always kind of bleak to me. But I'm glad to hear, Abby, that didn't come to mind first for you, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, that's a little clearer for me. I guess what you're sort of meaning is like a zenith of contentedness in the human race. Like, this is good, and all of our needs are met, and like reasonable happiness and flourishing is there. As far as like what this is sort of prophesying, I think, unfortunately, this is my opinion, the human condition is a little too bent toward greed and pride, where I gotta say, I don't think that maybe we're headed on a great track, but I think there are some moments where, I don't know, there are moments of hope and moments of clear thinking and righteous living.
What do you think about that, Adam?
I would agree with exactly that. The idea of greed and the, you know, thirst for power kind of ruining things for everyone. And I feel like that
we're just,
you know,
never going to get over that, are we?
I don't think so. I feel like so many of these stories come back to the kind of human nature and, you know, people who want to go against that and maybe do the honorable thing. But I also think of things like, I'm terrible at character names, but Oscar Isaac Leto?
Leto?
Yeah, Leto, yeah.
Oh, ha-ha! I'm so impressed with myself. You know, he's kind of like the honorable character.
Yeah.
And, you know, he, spoiler, as we said, but he pays the price for it. And I also think, like, and this is, you know, a story set so far in the future, and you look at something like Game of Thrones, I would just say, you know, way in the past, there's a similar character. I would say the Sean Bean Stark, the honorable man who pays the price for it.
It never pays to be honorable.
Yeah. And so I feel like, yeah, there's a lot to be read into that. That is kind of a recurring motif in these, I mean, different types of stories, but stories in general.
Let me get Matt Kelly's take on this with this caveat. I know that when I say this could be the most comfortable time in human history, there is a massive load of privilege and sort of naivete there because of the resources we're currently using, the changes we haven't yet made that we could and probably, well, certainly should, what that might entail. I'm not sitting here saying, oh, it's great to be using the amount of fossil fuels we're using. I'm just observing that if we don't make real change, films like this are kind of a warning that wars over resources, power struggles, inegalitarianism is going to be a forever story until there is no human race.
Yeah, I think that's an important caveat, because the first thing I thought of is most comfortable time for who and
yeah,
where.
I acknowledge that.
I'm sure folks in Afghanistan would feel very differently about
that. Of course.
That, right?
No, of course.
Yeah. No, I'm just adding to that. And I think it was interesting to me also that you read or saw the movie as being very bleak. I know much of science fiction over the past couple decades has focused on these sort of stories of apocalypse, like Walking Dead and all these sorts of the world ends and how do we just survive by, you know.
But you didn't think this was bleak?
No, I didn't at all. I thought it was different. And for me, you know, human nature is not going to go away, right? Like, and this is a story that sort of just puts that in your face. We're always going to have greedy people. And the questions become, how do we mitigate that? How do we push back against it? And, you know, I think human history is replete with same story, different version, right? Like, that's what we see again and again and again. And maybe that's why the Bene Gesserit are trying to perfect humans, to break that cycle. That's me projecting a little bit into the reading of it. Not that their methods justify the ends.
Right.
But, you know, for me, what we're also seeing now in science fiction is what's called solarpunk, which is this idea that let's think about, instead of focusing on apocalypse, let's focus on, let's start telling stories about what we actually want to see, not what we're afraid of, but what we actually want to see. And as I think about those two sort of categories of storytelling in science fiction, I think quite unintentionally, Dune runs a middle ground of that. Dune very much runs the middle ground of that because, I mean, the Fremen are perfectly content and happy and fulfilled. They're being exploited by colonial powers and they don't like that. And they're fighting back against it even before Paul shows up on the scene. But they have, I mean, and Herbert does a brilliant job of sort of creating this very rich culture for these people in this book.
I have to say, you've convinced me a little bit more that it is more of a middle ground. It's not necessarily bleak. And I'll give the last 30 seconds to Abby. Tell people why you think that if they're not into Dune yet, that they would benefit from giving this a spin.
Cool. I mean, it is a movie decades in the making. So many people have tried. So many people have put their own spin on it with their own philosophies. But ultimately, I really think whoever goes to watch it is going to have a really great time visually, soundtrack wise. Oh, man, it's a feast for sure.
How cool is it that there are aircraft that perfectly mirror bugs? It's really cool. I love watching
Can't invent anything new.
Yeah, really cool. And by the way, Abby, there was an actual Dune film in the 1980s, right? I didn't make that up, right?
Nope, 84.
Was it any good?
I mean, I liked it, but I loved Lynch, so.
We finally have disagreement. Matt Kelly, was it any good?
Absolutely not.
Oh, wow. Did you see it, Adam Lubitow?
I did, and it's a trip, even more than this current movie.
Yes, that's it.
It's a trip. This was a trip. This was a fun conversation. I'm grateful for the time. Abby Sitterly, thanks for making the time for us.
Thank you.
Adam Lubitow, great to have you. Abby's a Dune fan and freelance writer. Adam, film writer, of course, and programmer. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
And Matt Kelly, the Dune super fan. Not as bleak as I thought.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, man. Our thanks to Megan Mack and Rob Braden and Emery Stein. Evan Dawson saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow.